Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robust, just periwig-painted fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
Well, Henny, you better hang on to your bear bodkin, because you're going to hate this. It's John Malden and T. Quillen, your hosts for the Inexplicable Dumb Show, starting now.
Hi, and welcome to episode 231 of...
The Inexplicable Dumb Show.
I'm T. Quillen.
I'm John Malden.
Wow.
What a weekend.
What a weekend. And what an ending to it. So as we're sitting here, my flight's been canceled.
Yay!
Woo-hoo!
So, anyway, we're still sitting here in Louisville. We decided we'd go ahead and... Louisville. You have to say that with a mouthful of marbles, don't you? We're here with our lovely... What title did we give her again? Production intern assistant...
Assistant
to the production intern, wasn't it?
Something like that.
Yeah. Are you allowed to talk?
At least she asks.
Well, that's true. She doesn't just butt in. You want the short mic?
I don't care.
Okay.
This one. Cool. This does seem to be the popular mic today.
It does. So this is Lauren Street. How are you?
I'm well. How are y'all?
Fantastic job.
Yes.
It's Louisville.
Louisville?
Louisville.
Okay.
L-O-O-A-V-U-L. Louisville.
Okay, Louisville. Cool. Well, she's gone native then. So so this week, it's going to be... we're going to hear from the writer and director of Maple and Vine.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be written by Jordan Harrison and directed by Annie Kaufman.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And then next up is going to be...
Edith can shoot things and
that's
hit
it.
Them.
Thank you for reading that, because I didn't... Yeah, that's the title of the play.
Mm-hmm.
I almost said Devil at Noon. That's going to be next week or something. Anyway, that was written by A. Ray Pamatmat.
Mm-hmm.
And
nicely
directed...
Done.
Thank you very much. And directed by May Adrales. So,
Silent N.
That's right. No N. So it's really silent. It's not even present.
Oh.
Non-present N.
Non-present N.
Yep.
Gonna watch out for those.
Yeah, and let's see. Next week we're gonna hear about Bob and Devil at Noon. That's what we're gonna do next week. So
sounds good.
Let's do this week first though.
Okay.
Stay current with the Inexplicable Dumb Show.
It's quick and it's easy and it's free.
Click the subscribe button at inexplicabledumbshow.com
and you'll never have to miss an episode.
I am someone you will probably never meet.
Yet I ask you to take time to think about people you don't know but need your help. Children, some of them. And they don't all play,
don't
in, the gutter,
all play
of course,
in the gutter, of course. Well, maybe if it's called for.
These men, women, and yes, even the children are professional actors. They want and need your time, money, and support.
For just pennies a second, you can enjoy the fruits of their labor. Make sure they know you heard about them on the Inexplicable Dumb Show. They may look at you funny, but that doesn't matter. It's for the children.
It's for the children.
It's time once again for some deep fried theater!
We are here with Jordan Harrison and Annie Kaufman, and they were the team that brought us Maple and Vine. Jordan, you wrote it, yes?
That's right.
And Annie, you directed it.
I did.
Awesome. Okay, so you two, tell us about it. Just kind of give our listeners a little synopsis of it to get us started, and then we'll talk about it.
I'm going to do that. Wow. Synopsis. Yeah, what is it about?
Jordan? It's about Maple and Vine. Sorry, speaking complete sentences.
Yes.
Maple and Vine is about a 30-something couple named Kath and Ryu, and an urban couple, and there's some very real reasons for their unhappiness. They just had a miscarriage, but more than anything, it's they just have this kind of urban malaise, and they've lost track of themselves. They don't like themselves.
And each other.
Yeah. and on the day that Kath quits her job, she meets a man from a 1955 reenactionist society. He lives in a place where a kind of gated community, where it's 1955 every day, and people try to forget that there's things like the internet and I don't know, equality in the workplace and so forth. It sounds attractive, doesn't it? Yeah. and what becomes, so they decide as a kind of like mad lark to go move to 1955, because, you know, they'll try anything at this point. And the sort of surprise of the play is that it works for them and it makes them kind of whole again, to sort of have to follow this set of rules and to have social boundaries that they don't have in 2011. How was that?
Do you agree? Do you agree with everything he just said?
I do. Except there's a little addition I made. I think that was, yeah, it's very articulate.
That brought it all together. That encapsulates addition.
What the play's about.
Oh, cool. Well, so inspiration for the play?
Ooh, it's such a long, long story. Let's try to boil it down. In the beginning, Annie actually brought the project to me. It was a kind of documentary theater project for the civilians.
Mm-hmm. Theater company in New York.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Who've been to Humana before. And Annie had hundreds of interviews with the Amish, Civil War reenactors, mm-hmm. cloistered nuns, all kinds of people that have made the choice to, or not made the choice, but been born into the choice to live outside the modern world. And so originally my job was to sort of do a brilliant collage piece with these interviews, and I actually made an entire draft, and Annie and I sat down and she said, you know, the ideas are coming out of people's mouths, like it's too much on the surface, you know, I see you maneuvering us, and I agreed.
That is definitely the short version.
Yeah. Hesitantly. I know I make you sound like a laser, don't I?
And you're so complicit.
Yes, Annie. Anything you say.
Yes, I love this.
That's how the collaboration works.
That sounds exactly like our meetings, actually.
And so I did something that I'd never done before. I threw out an entire draft and decided to take a crack at the play, just doing what I know best, which is fiction. And I had this idea for a 1950s society and just the act of having to make up the rules of this place rather than reporting on. I mean, one of the issues with the interviews is that so many of them were with people who had no doubts, you know, or certainly
were proselytized. I mean, mm-hmm. they had joined mm-hmm. out of, you know, from, you know, their own free will, you know, sort of becoming a cloistered nun is obviously a choice. We interviewed cult members who had, you know, the desire to somehow step outside of the modern world, and they had a kind of spiel that because I think a lot of people do ask them about their choices, and so it was very difficult to kind of crack beneath the surface and get something mm-hmm. real from them and what mm-hmm. really was going on inside, because they were kind of proselytizing.
Sure.
You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So we threw that out, and Jordan. The interesting thing I think is that there is, even though this is fiction and came all from Jordan's brain, there are passages in the play that are directly from these interviews.
I was going to say, yeah. I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah, no.
I don't doubt that at all.
Significant chunk is from a cloistered nun who's been sort of dropped into the body of Paul Niebank playing Dean, you know, and I think that recontextualization was something that was intriguing and satisfying to us.
And yeah. The reason that I brought, you know, the sort of inspiration for the interviewing process originally is I'm from a large family, 6 kids, 5 girls, 1 boy, and my mother once said to us, all of the girls, she said, I'm really sorry for you guys because you have so many choices now in the 20th and mm-hmm. 21st century. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, you know, I knew I was going to get married and have kids, and now you have all of these to have kids, not to have kids, to have a career, not to have a career. And I also, my husband, then boyfriend, and I visited a Hasidic Jewish restaurant where the proprietor of the restaurant took a shine to us. We were the only non-Hasids in the joint. And he was talking to us about his arranged marriage and the fact that there's a special rabbi who 3 days before a wedding visits the man and tells the man how babies are made, and you know, with the assumption that up until that point, the men have no access to any information about how babies are made. And this is a community who lives in Brooklyn, in the middle of the information age, with internet access. You know, but they have strict they have restrictions on their internet, and and the Talmud, they black out the stuff about procreation. So you know, whether or not you believe that, the whether or not you believe that these men, you know, I was very interested in the reasoning behind, or the sort of desire to maintain these kind of restrictions. And at the time, having some problems with my boyfriend, now my husband, I thought the idea of an arranged marriage sounded kind of brilliant. those things seem to work. So this actually set me on this sort of quest of why people are interested in sidestepping the modern world.
Yeah. I love this piece. It really stopped and made you think, because it was to me it was a nice balance, because there is so much of that nuclear family thing that you do when you go back and you watch the Ozzie and Harriet's, and you watch the, you know, all the 50s TV shows, you do have that longing for that. You know, you're like, oh geez, why can't we all be like, you know, Wally and the Beaver? Geez, right. Can't it all be like that? Right. Golly gee, you know. But then there's
hell.
Well, you know, it really is. I was also because I was watching Ozzie and Harriet, and I you know, for the project, and I was like, I'm bored to tears.
Right, but didn't get through a single episode. Yeah,
there's the idea behind it, though. You know, I mean, that that's yeah. Of course, it would be.
Right.
You know, what are we having again, hon? I don't know. Let's listen to the radio and find out. Yeah, no, that would be horrible.
Yeah.
He says on an audio podcast.
Sponsored by the people who brought us.
That's right. Right.
I mean, although the drinking would be good.
Yeah.
And the smoking.
I think we're sort of expecting it to travel to Ozzie and Harriet land. And what happens is that it turns out a little bit more like the world of Douglas Sirk, where there's these like roiling things under the surface, you know,
which is
hopefully
again, I think the thing that you bring up in the play, this is a lot more like what it was really like, you know, and that's, to me, that was the interesting thing about it is that, yeah, you can try to go back to this ideal of what it was like, but what you're going to find is that you try to go back for the ideal, and what's instantly going to surface is the reality of what it's like.
That's right.
And the reality is what's actually attractive, not being a
plasticine
Stepford wife.
Right. You know? Yeah. The tension between the sort of what's on the surface and then what's actually happening inside. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the implication, though, that you could leave the modern world, but pick kind of your role in the so, you know, if you have a boring modern life, you can go back and be a beat poet.
Yes, exactly.
Although no one seems to choose that, surprisingly.
No, I know.
Well, not in this play. Yeah, not right. In the world that we have. I think that there are beat poets in this community.
Definitely.
In this gated community, which is also a really nice contradiction.
Yeah, right.
You know.
I really enjoyed the piece. I thought it was a lot of fun. It was bold. It was it was well balanced. Made you think. What was it? You said at intermission. Lights came up. I pulled out my iPhone.
Because he went on about, I could get into being in 1955.
You know. And you were not Googling 1955, were you?
No, I was not.
Instant messaging.
No, honestly, here's the funny thing about that, because this also ties into the play, too. I was actually texting my wife to tell her, I just saw this great play about reconnecting with your wife. You know? And so he was just like, yeah, you'd never make it. And I was like, no, but you don't get the other half of this, you know.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, that was actually something that did land with me about this piece, was that whole finding yourself in a rut, in a relationship, finding yourself in a rut, and then two people wanting desperately to figure out whatever it is that's causing that problem and get out of it. That really landed with me, and it's something that my wife and I did. We had to work out, and you fight to get through, you know, and do whatever it takes, even if you go into we didn't go into a gated community. So not
it's
for the
time.
Not yet.
Ours was the 1850s, though. Ours was.
No, you wouldn't do well either.
No, that's true. So. No, 2050s maybe. I guess.
Right. Get to be a future society.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it, though. It was a lot of fun.
So congratulations on being the father of the 1955 reactionary societies.
I know. Yeah. Maybe it'll be like L. Ron Hubbard. And yeah.
That's right.
Take hold.
So 200 years from now, when they uproot this podcast and it's in a time capsule somewhere, this name is going to be listed, right? This name is going to be listed as the father of the SDO.
That's right.
That's right.
And everyone will pray, right, like Joseph Smith. Everyone will find this and they'll be...
My legacy. No abortions. Oh dear. I had no idea.
It all started here.
Yeah. Right.
Posthumously famous and rich.
That's it.
Yeah.
Rich. Really quickly, what's next for both of you guys? Where do you go after this? Other than the cult, what's next for you guys?
Exactly. We laugh because on Monday we land back in New York and then we go to Penn Station and get on a train together to start our next project together.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
It's nice that we're pleased with this one.
Podcast, yeah.
Nice,
right?
Good.
We're doing a children's musical in Philadelphia based on a Hans Christian Andersen story. Very short story. I finally read it.
It's about two pages long. Yeah.
It was really that actually impressed. Like, I have to say, I'm impressed.
Well, it's easier. I'd rather have the chance to expand something than have to boil down a giant Dostoevsky novel.
No, that's true.
For the 5-year-old.
But this is quite, yeah.
No War and Peace or anything like that for the 5-year-old.
It's its own little War and Peace. It's its own little Crime and Punishment, The Flea and the Professor. So that happens at the Arden starting Monday. Actually, they're starting without us because they're learning the music. Flying back, and then Tuesday morning we'll start rehearsals for that.
That's cool.
With a Seattle composer named Richard Gray, who's kind of fabulous.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Best of luck to you guys.
Yeah, Thank you so much.
Thanks for sitting with us.
Yeah.
The name of the play is Edith Can Shoot Things and Hit Them, and we're here with Ray Pamatmat and May Adralis. Did I do that right?
Yes.
See, I got that part right.
So that's the important
That's why you
stuff.
Wear the tie.
It is. That's true. Mm-hmm. That is true. I have to wear the tie for that reason. How are you guys doing?
Well.
give us a little synopsis of the play for our listeners who have not seen it yet.
Well, we're closed, so they can't see it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're hoping it will go on, right? They will have another opportunity.
Yeah, it is actually, this is the first stop in a Rolling World premiere, so it'll be in a couple other cities. So it's about three kids who are pretty much abandoned on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and how they build a life together that the outside world doesn't really approve of, and so the outside world comes kind of tumbling in and tries to take it apart.
Cool. And there, I was your bio basically says that this was pulled somewhat from a, I don't know, you called yourself a latchkey kid, I think, right?
Yeah.
So this is sort of quasi autobiographical.
I think like the best way to put it is that's a lot of the emotions are, you know, they're from my life, but the situations are they're very exaggerated.
Sure.
And quite different.
Sure.
Like none of the actual events in the play happened.
It's in a reputation protect mode. You know that? Yeah.
It's all a big lie.
Well, I thought that was a fascinating point to start from, was the latchkey thing, because I wasn't left alone on a farm or anything, but I would definitely.
We're all defending that now. That's where we're all starting from.
I did live in the middle of nowhere. I will concede that in a farming community in Illinois.
There you go.
But we weren't farmers. But I did have to come home after school and let myself in. I mean, I wasn't, you know, as extreme, but I thought that was a neat idea, that phenomenon that sort of, a term that sort of developed in the late 80s, and you know, of this, these kids just having to fend for themselves, basically.
Hmm.
But I do like the idea that you have that it is set in the middle of nowhere, and that they did go play in a barn, because that's... Well, we didn't when we we go crawl to the highest rafter, because that's what you do when no one's around.
Yeah,
we didn't shoot things though.
Well, I'm from the South. That's it. That's precisely what we did. That's exactly what we did.
That comes right out of the crib gun, right?
That's right. Yeah. Well, in some cases, in the reverse order. So other than the Latchkey Kid, what else is the inspiration for the story? I mean, why this story and why now for you?
I started the play when I was working on another play that was big and huge and ridiculous. So another part of it, and probably part of it also coming from a more personal place, was just to sort of simplify things. It mm-hmm. was, you know, I really wanted to write something with only a few people mm-hmm. and, you know, in a mostly realistic vein. And, you know, so that's pretty much where I came from.
Okay. Let's talk about the production notes, just because we're not completely ignoring you. So we haven't asked you anything
Shan
yet.
Shan piped up about being a latchkey kid.
I know.
I was a latchkey kid. Okay, and maybe. I did grow up in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
I had the connections to the play as well.
There you go. So we'll talk about the process. I mean, the 3-week process. I mean, tell us a little bit about it. What did you guys, any experience? I mean, anything neat happened throughout the process? I mean, anything in the exploration?
Unusual, let's
yeah,
say.
Yeah.
Unexpected, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, unexpectedly, it was not unexpectedly, but pleasantly surprised how it was truly one of the best experiences. Mm. I mean, rehearsal experiences I've ever had. The cast, you know, you're doing a play about building a family, and the cast essentially becomes your family.
Right.
And you know, we started to fall into those roles very yeah. easily. Because Ray and I were joking that we started referring to them as our kids.
Right. Ah, okay, right.
And that we were mom and dad, except he was the mom and I was the dad.
And it was very true. It was very accurate.
Awesome.
Because I'm like the disciplinarian. I have all the notes. Ray's just there with hugs and food. And
so with this play, that means that you were never at rehearsals, right? Is that what it
is? No, we were
directed it.
Right. I only called on the phone.
That's
you know?
Right.
Deposit yeah. the paycheck.
Stage left. Click. The play itself, it works on so many levels. But the day that we saw it, the whole house seemed to really connect with one specific character. The title, the character that's in the title is Edith, but John and I were talking last night. We're not so sure that it's a play about Edith. Would you agree with that or not?
I mean, I think every time you watch a play, you're watching it through the lens of whatever experience that you have and mm-hmm. what you mm-hmm. are most drawn to. Because
sure.
That's true for some people.
Sure.
They are, you know, drawn to one certain character. And
mm-hmm.
It's surprising how many people have come up to me and said that this experience of like being left alone mm-hmm. and being the oldest mm-hmm. sibling responsible for the younger, or being the youngest mm-hmm. sibling and not understanding what happened to the parents
mm-hmm.
Was their experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is the... I think it's different for everybody.
Right, sure.
So, in your version of the play, can mm-hmm. be Benji's afraid of shooting things.
but
in the end.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. That's very true.
Well, I mean, I think what I really loved about it was their defining of what... Kenny and Benji's relationship and what that meant and how to go about having the relationship, I thought was beautifully created. Because there was the innocence that didn't get lost per se, but enriched that relationship.
Well, it was the purity of just the... For me, it was the purity of it was the exploration of just having a relationship. Regardless of the relationship, and that was that to me on a lot of levels really worked. Kenny was the character I connected most with, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, because of the older brother thing.
Oh,
because
yeah.
of the older brother thing, and I could see a lot of myself, the growth and the having to grow up thing. You know, having to realize that you're having to step up thing. That's what really connected with me with this one, and. I don't know. It's interesting you say that.
I connected with Benji's mother. Did you? Because you know, well, I love you, Mom. And yeah.
She called, you know. So never mind.
But yeah, so no, the fact that the Benji's coming from a kind of tight family, mm-hmm. tight control family, mm-hmm. I could definitely relate to that.
Sure.
So, but the moment when after the note, and Edith says something like, "I'll protect you," you're right. Oh my God!
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah,
wow. Because there's the young, the 12 year old, right, character understands their relationship.
Yeah.
More than the parent and the biologically tied. Yeah. I would just
beautiful moment.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, it really, really was. That was another one of those moments that I was in tears. I didn't tell you that one.
Because I was in tears alongside you.
Well, I know.
So it's different than the other time that you were in tears.
I know.
Where I felt embarrassed for you.
That was because you stepped on my toe. So what's next for you guys? What is up for individually or collectively? What is up for you?
Well,
after Humana.
The Rolling World premiere is Humana is the first stop in a Rolling World premiere for this play.
Okay.
So I know the other theaters, but we still haven't figured out dates or directors or actors or any of that stuff. The NNPN, the National New Play Network, are the people who do the Rolling World premiere. And I guess in an ideal universe, there would be a different director and cast for every production. Mm-hmm. But I think the casting demands for this, that might change it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
right. And rightfully, yeah.
Yeah.
Rightfully so, I think. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. Because it's not just
the family together.
Right. It's not just ethnic specificity, but I think that it's also finding adults that can play children mm-hmm. or teenagers, because it's you can't really do the show with actual teenagers.
Right.
And yeah, so there are a couple of strange casting things that might affect that model. And then I have a workshop of another play in Chicago in May at the American Theater Company, a play called Beautiful Day.
Cool.
So that's what I have next.
That's great.
And May is going to be crazy in the next few weeks.
I'm working on a lot of new plays right now.
Like all of them?
Apparently all in the same place, in the same room at the same time.
It's really crazy. No, I work with Tommy Smith, and the last production I did in New York was his, and we're working on a new play together. And then Club Thumb, which is a cool downtown group, they're doing Kristen Neubaum and David Hancock's new play, Our Lot, in their Summer Works Festival this summer. And then I'll be back sort of around this area, Milwaukee Rep, in the fall, directing Yellow Man.
Cool. Wow, so you're busy, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good time to be busy, though. Yeah. Awesome. Best of luck to you guys. This was a great piece.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. It's a very strong piece.
Yeah. Unofficially my favorite one.
Unofficially?
Yeah. You just
I have to get the bias.
That's now on record. That's official.
If you love the Inexplicable Dumb Show like I do, don't be shy about it. Go ahead and wear your feelings on your sleeve, or at least your chest. Head on over to our Cafe Press store and wear your support for the IDS proudly. www.cafepress.com/dumbshow.
So I guess we should thank Jordan and Annie.
Yeah, Maple and Vine.
That's right. And Ray and May.
Edith can shoot things and hit them.
Very well done.
In beautiful Louisville.
Louisville, was that right?
Louisville.
Did he do well?
Yes, he did.
At the 35th annual Humanana.
Jesus.
They got me self-conscious.
I'm going to read it now. It's the 35th Humana. This is what it says on the cover. 35th Humana of Festival New American Plays.
The poster's painted funny. It lives out all the...
Well, that's what we're going to go with. That's kind of how we've said it all day.
Yeah, we've got it right. That's the material that we've been given.
Maybe we should have just said that. You know, that's what we've been saying all day.
Yeah.
We got it right anyway. Next week, we're going to hear about Bob and Devil at Noon.
All right.
Hey, we'll see you.
Bye.
This podcast is a member of the Blueberry Network. Blueberry. No E's. That's Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com. Blueberry.com.
Pop Alternative Media.